You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of March 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
The Russians can't change us or significantly weaken us. They are a smaller country. They are a weaker country. Their economy doesn't produce anything that anybody wants to buy except oil and gas and arms.
Which doesn't mean they weren't worth keeping an eye on. Reports suggest that Barack Obama's administration spent some of its final months collating evidence of the Trump campaign's ties with Moscow. My guests, Daniela Peled and Michael Binion, will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including Poland worrying about Russia on Ukraine's behalf, Sweden reintroducing compulsory military service, and online comment sections. Is there any way of improving them, or indeed anything to be said for them? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Daniela Peled, Managing Editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Michael Binion, Foreign Affairs Specialist at The Times. Welcome both. And we will start with Russia, concerns about the expansionist ambitions of which have mostly recently been focused on the United States, and indeed will be again later in this programme. Countries in Russia's immediate neighbourhood, however, have not ceased worrying that Moscow may not be content with its 2014 acquisition of Crimea. Poland's Foreign Minister Witold Waszczykowski, on a visit to Ukraine, has suggested that Russia may also look to annex the Donbass region of that country. Daniela, first of all, what allowance should we make here for the fact that it's possibly in Poland's interests to flam up fears of Russian expansion?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think he's somewhat exaggerating the fears, but I have enormous sympathy with his reasons for doing so, not least because Ukraine's situation there seems to have been largely forgotten. People are focused on other issues at the moment. But there is cause for concern. I mean, the Russians are sending a number of very pointed signals. I think from March the 1st, the ruble is going to be the supposed currency of the region, and they're already also recognising travel documents issued by the pro-Russian forces. So all of these measures, while not quite pointing to annexation, are intended to rile up feelings at a time when everything is in flux and no one is quite sure what's going to happen in terms of the messages coming from the White House. And Europe is very much concerned with other issues, not least Brexit and number of elections across the area. So I think he's exaggerating the fear, but with some good reason.
Michael, if we look at this from Moscow's point of view, is there any reason why it would want to annex Donbass? Because if you actually annex a portion of a country and the people therein, you do acquire yourself a certain measure of responsibility and a whole load of trouble. Whereas what they have now is it not a frozen conflict like as they have in Abkhazia and South Ossetia, with which they can turn up or down as and when it suits them without really having to take any responsibility for it?
Well, that's absolutely right. I agree entirely. I think it's not in their interest to annex it at all because, first of all, they would then have to pay a large amount of money to reconstruct many of these areas, which have been really bombed to bits. I mean, shelling has been going on without people really noticing in the outside world, and a lot of the infrastructure is badly damaged and will need a lot of money pouring into it. Secondly, they do then have to assume responsibility for the people there themselves. Now, they aren't all fervently pro-Russian. Some are not so content with what's been going on. And as you say, they can have the best of both worlds by having it as a frozen conflict, as, for example, the two you mentioned, or Transnistria, or well, these other places, where you have a sort of friendly Russian regime, but actually still technically part of another country.
I would say, though, that I don't believe it's got to that state yet of a frozen conflict. It would be, I think, one of the ideal situations for Russia. But it is actually right now an active conflict. And these are the attempts at ceasefire that have been going on for a number of years. Enormous amounts of violations in just the first 3 months of this year. So the idea that it will maybe become eventually one of these frozen conflicts that are politically and diplomatically useful, that perhaps is the end game. Right now, it's in a much more active phase.
Michael, just to follow that up, though, Daniela mentioned a certain amount of flux and uncertainty in the Western world with elections pending in France and the Netherlands, people still trying to figure out what Donald Trump is going to mean. Does Trump's accession in particular make, if not annexation of Donbass, then further and other shenanigans by Russia more likely?
No, I don't think so. In fact, at the moment, I think the exact opposite is likely, because Putin has been, to some extent, slightly hurt by the accusation that Trump is just his puppet. And, of course, what he's worried about is there will be a counterblast where Trump will try to show, I'm fully independent, and people will say, well, you can't do any deals with Russia because, first of all, you're in their pocket, and secondly, they're entirely irresponsible and unreliable. So, for the moment, I think Putin is determined to show, I'm a really good, reliable world leader, and I'm going to help do a deal in Syria, and I'm going to help do this and that and the other. He's hoping that on the side they'll say, well, let's just do a deal on Ukraine. But he's not going to push the situation to the point where the Americans then turn around and say, well, actually, we thought we could work with the Russians and we can't.
Daniela, is there room here for a faintly optimistic analysis of what Trump might mean for Russia? Because I'm trying. You know,
you're asking the wrong person here.
Well, possibly. But in the last few years in particular, Russia has cornered the market on being volatile, unpredictable, beyond norms, beyond the law, etc., etc., because they've been able to predict how everybody else would respond, and now they can't do that.
Well, I think what Michael says is one possibility, but it's one possibility of many. And I know we're going to discuss this later in the programme, but I think the issue of Russia still remains in the US somewhat bipartisan. I think we have got a while to go before there's a consensus that we can do business with them from the American point of view, that they're not a threat, that they are a logical actor. Putin's both his tactics and his strategy is to keep a number of irons in the fire at the same time and a number of alliances. And it's worked very well for him. I see no sign that he would want to stop.
Well, let's move on then to that ongoingly diverting question of the relationship between the Trump White House and the Kremlin. As another row descends over contacts between pre-election contacts, rather, between Trump appointees and Russia, this time involving Attorney General Jeff Sessions, it has also emerged that officials in the Obama administration labored to preserve evidence of links between Trump's campaign and Russia so that future investigators, one of whom will hopefully not be Jeff Sessions, all things considered, could more easily find them. Michael, again, as is the case with so many of these stories, it's very hard to see the bottom of them. Do we yet, at the risk of mixing the metaphor, properly understand how much fire there is beneath all the smoke?
I don't think we do. I think there is a strong suspicion that the Russians have some sort of what they would call kompromat, compromising material, on Trump. I don't really believe all about the stories of the shenanigans in the hotel and that kind of thing, but I do think something to do with money or his intermediaries getting kind of favourable treatment in a business deal of some kind, there may be something in the background there. We don't know. Of course, what the Russians have done quite cleverly is to allow a certain amount of this stuff to leak out and then also deliberately leak stuff that is completely exaggerated so that the whole lot can then be denied. And you can say, well, look, this is obviously ridiculous and exaggerated and these facts don't stack up, so how can you believe any of the story? So we don't actually know what is true and what is not. What we do know, though, is that the Trump administration was prepared to start again with the Russians. And it's quite logical that they could have had discussions with the Russians. I think it's pretty stupid to say that nobody should even have talked to the Soviet. Sorry, there's a slip of the tongue. Continuity we're talking about. To the Russian ambassador in Washington. Why not? I mean, he's an ambassador. Why not? What was silly is to say, we never talked to him, we never saw him. Now, that was really foolish. They should simply have said, of course we've been discussing things with the Russians. We are hoping to do business with them.
Daniela, I'm going to ask you another just-for-fun question. if there is, as the Trump White House keeps insisting, absolutely nothing to any of this, that there is no sort of disreputable or unsavoury contact and has been none, etc., 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 what is the best way for Trump to make this go away? Because this is working to his disadvantage. We saw the other day he managed to give a speech to the houses of, or the both houses of Congress, without I mean, I don't know. I'm baffled by the media response to that speech. You know, sort of grown man read 4,800 words from a teleprompter without mishap.
Well, look at the stock market response to that.
Exactly, and all of a sudden thinks he's Washington crossing the Delaware. But if there is nothing at the bottom of any of this at all, if Donald Trump is being unfairly maligned and traduced, how can he make this go away?
Well, he probably thinks perhaps tweeting at 3 a.m. But I think, this whole story, we don't know. The layers of a fact and counterfact and alternative fact behind it. But I think what it says about the American administration is how the Obama administration prepared for the Trump to come in as if it was a hostile takeover, as if it was more of a coup, as if it was an enemy force laying the ground, not just accepting the inevitable, but recording the documents, keeping a record for history for possible prosecutions. I mean, I think that is the important takeaway for this. There's very little that Trump can do in the long term about that because, and I'll be uncharacteristically optimistic for a moment, it's a sign that perhaps the institutions of American democracy and the establishment are strong enough to resist this, or 4 years or whatever it turns out to be of a Trump administration, because these are institutions with an eye on the long term, taking it very, very seriously and actually creating a record, a public record or private record of what might happen in the future. Now, nothing Trump can do in his sort of very flimsy and very short term and very grandstanding actions, which are mostly intended to play to his own constituency, can really counteract that.
Michael, looking at Attorney General Jeff Sessions, how deep is the soup surrounding him? There's been some suggestions, predictably enough, I guess, from senior Democrats that this is in fact a resigning issue. But even Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, a friend of Jeff Sessions, thinks he should recuse himself from investigating any links between Trump and Russia. Is his position still tenable?
Just about. I think it is a very tricky one. I mean, his fault, is simply denying that he had contacts with the Russian ambassador. And that's extremely stupid.
Well, he's trying to squeeze out of this one by claiming that the question he answered was about whether he discussed the election with the Russian ambassador.
The election. Yes.
And he's saying he didn't. And if that is the case, then it's as you were saying earlier, there doesn't strike me as any reason why an American senator should not meet the Russian ambassador.
Exactly. Well, whether... he could say we didn't talk about Russian help for the Trump campaign, of course. If they did talk about the election, who's to prove it? I mean, it's something we simply don't know what they talked about, unless somebody made a recording, which probably the Russian ambassador's office has got one there already. But
you'd think when the ashtrays start revolving, that's when you realise that there's an issue.
I think he's in a difficult position. I think it would be sensible to take himself out of it. On the other hand, that does suggest a level of involvement or indeed blame, which I think he's determined not to admit.
Is that the position Sessions is now in, though, Daniela, that he either has to tough this out or quit? Because as Michael says, if one of your very first acts as Attorney General is to recuse yourself from a major investigation into the foreign corruption of your country's election system because you may be implicated in that, it's not a good start, is it?
It's not a good start. It's not a good start. But really, again, we're in a different and completely uncharted era. The fact that there's even an accusation around this in a previous administration would have been the end. Similarly, Donald Trump gives us a halfway normal speech and people are amazed and impressed and the stock market jumps in response. It would be very embarrassing for him if there was another, decapitation. That's not quite
defenestration.
Right. Defenestration. so soon. But... remains to be seen.
I mean, is that's got to be part of his calculations, though, Michael, hasn't it? Because, I mean, your national security advisor and your attorney general going overboard in the first 6 weeks, again, that's a deep hole to dig yourself out of.
It is, yes. But on the other hand, he's dug himself out of plenty of deeper holes, even during the campaign. I mean, he's on record as having said things which everyone would have said was absolutely the end of any politician in America, but it wasn't. Whether America is becoming inured to this, or whether they simply say, well, these are your facts, these are my facts, and you simply then dismiss reality and say, well, that's alternative reality and all that. And finally, you get to the point of saying, do the voters really care? Do my supporters really care? And do my people in Congress care enough to either impeach me or to take out civil actions against me? Well, I think he calculates probably not.
Well, on that happy thought, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Daniela Pellad and Michael Binion. Do stay tuned.
New decade, new monocle. No biggie. After 10 years of doing it like that, we're now doing it like this. A refresh, a redesign, showing a bit of editorial leg. So, we'll meet the huddle behind the controversial hard man, President Duterte of the Philippines. We'll meet the people that decide what you'll watch next at Netflix. We'll investigate the boom industry, the business of sleep. And we'll wonder what we can learn from architecture designed with animals in mind. And there's a hound on the cover just so we could have a story about dogs with jobs. The headline, The Dog's Barracks. Monocle, issue 101. Out now.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Daniela Pellad and Michael Binion. Now let's look now at Sweden, which, like many European countries, phased out compulsory military service in the post-Cold War years. However, like a few countries who live in the general vicinity of Russia, coincidentally enough, Sweden now proposes to reintroduce conscription. At least to begin with, 4,000 people born in 1999 will be called up on January 1st to serve from 9 to 12. 12 months. Michael, Sweden's defence ministry have explicitly said, more or less, this is prompted by Russia's recent behaviour. Is this an overreaction on their part?
I don't think it is, no. I think the Swedes are pretty hard-headed people. They're pretty well able to calculate other people's behaviour and interests, and they know...
Which has, of course, kept them out of any serious wars for about 200 years now, since I think a punch-up with Norway in the early 19th century.
That's right. It has indeed. And that, it's rather like Switzerland. Because they've kept out of wars, they spend a great deal of time keeping themselves safe. I mean, the Swiss have compulsory military service and have had for years and years. In the old days, they all built nuclear shelters because they had to be prepared. The Swedes have a very strong and tough army, which up till now has mostly been just used in peacekeeping. But because the Swedes have this rather kind of general laid-back image of sort of men with beards sitting around getting suntanned on islands, it doesn't mean that they're not extremely tough soldiers. And indeed they are. And they would be a pretty formidable, fierce fighting force.
Daniela, there have also been mutterings about reintroducing conscription in Poland, Lithuania, among others, again, in the general vicinity of Russia. Is that in itself a victory for Russia in compelling its near adversaries to spend money they might not have wanted to on their defence?
Well, look, it makes perfect logical sense. I think we've all become a bit too used to the good life in Europe over decades and decades and decades. If there is a potential military threat, it makes sense to be prepared for that. I mean, the Swedish story, I think, is a little bit different because the numbers involved are not very large. I mean, 4,000 are going to be called up, but only a small proportion of those are going to serve. I think they're going to choose the most committed and the most motivated.
The most impressively bearded.
Exactly. So they're sending a message, and they're sending a message to the world, and they're sending a message to their own population, which I think the discussions in Poland and elsewhere also does, to say, this is a worry, we should be prepared for it, rather than saying we have to start building barricades and, you know, handing out arms for a civil defence force.
Hey, Michael, how symbolic is it, I guess, versus how strategic is it? Because when I've talked about conscription myself with professional soldiers of various nationalities, their attitude inclines towards the sceptical.
Yes, I don't think militarily conscription actually adds a great deal to an army's strength. In fact, even the Russian army has said that conscripts are not really very helpful. They're young, they're inexperienced, they're subject to terrible bullying in the Russian army, and the Russian army would probably be much more effective if it was an all-professional army. And because so many people dodge conscription in Russia, essentially it almost is an all-professional army. The point of conscription, as they argued for many years in West Germany, as it then was, is moral and patriotic. The point is to identify people with the defence of their country and to show young men and increasingly also young women that there is an actual duty. You owe a duty of responsibility to maintain your country's defence. I don't think by conscripting people into the army, you actually make your army that much more formidable.
Daniela, I am now of the age at which I wouldn't be called up until T-34s were rolling up the Strand, so I can take a fairly equable view of it. But are there non-military arguments in favour of conscription? Because there are countries, Switzerland in particular does this, I know it's a case made by the Israeli military as well, that their conscription is a powerful agent of social cohesion, that it encourages people to work with and meet and learn from people from backgrounds they would not otherwise have encountered. It gives people a sense of civic responsibility, etc., etc., etc. Is there anything to be said for that?
Well, that is absolutely the case with the Israeli army, and one justification why the country spends so very much on it. And one reason why the outside world thinks that the Israeli army is, you know, is so powerful, but it isn't because of the conscription. I mean, it's useful having trained people who can do reserve duty, but it's very much, as Michael said, identified with the country, nationalism, patriotism. I think there's a good argument to be made that in the 21st century, the army in a country shouldn't be the major institution of social change and education and social mobility. I mean, the Israeli army spends an enormous amount on education, an enormous amount. And one could make a very convincing case that that should be the responsibility of the government in a different form.
Michael, what do you think? Are there non-military arguments in favour of conscription? I'm also reminded of a conversation I had with an Israeli conscript who said that he thought, perhaps ironically, it was the best imaginable guarantee against a country being overrun by a military-industrial complex if the military was obliged to keep dealing with successive waves of civilians who would keep an eye on it.
Well, that's a very good argument. Yes, I haven't heard that one. Another argument that was commonly used in Germany is that actually this is a large pool of people who are obliged to give a certain number of years, or a year and a half or whatever, to the government service, and they could be used for all sorts of things. And in Germany, you had the opt-out clause where you didn't want to serve in a military role, but you were still obliged to serve in such things as being extra help in mental institutions or emergency relief work, or, you know, using people for floods and whatever. I mean, they use armies for that in any case. But you could have a permanent civil social service role as a conscript. And that was something where you were paid only a fairly modest amount, but you were available to do the sort of jobs that weren't being filled at the rate that people wanted them to. And that's a pretty good argument. It's not military national service, it's just national service.
Okay, well, finally tonight, let us take a journey to the bottom half of the internet. Comment sections on websites are, of course, all at once a plague, a bore and a menace, on the grounds that they are largely composed by the sort of people likely to post on comment sections. And as a consequence, a heartening quantity of outlets have recently begun expunging and or abolishing them. Norway's public broadcaster NRK thinks it might have found another way, forcing readers to take a quiz on the contents of a given article before they can respond beneath it with illiterate ravings about foreigners and the Bilderberg Group. Daniela, is this going to help?
I think it rather ignores part of the reason and part of the purpose of online commenting, which is a kind of extended care in the community and, you know, to help people who have something to say or perhaps a bit lonely or want to get a rant out. It's a little bit sort of self-serving and conceited, really. I mean, I'm sure lots of individual writers would like to impose these restrictions on their articles, saying, unless you read it and answer a quiz, you can't comment on my wise words.
Well, so my pet solution has always been that social media platforms should replace those cute little prompts like, you know, what do you think, or what's going on, or what's happening, with questions like, do you actually have the faintest clue what you're talking about, or are you really sure you've thought about this? Michael, you, like me, I'm sure, can remember a time when, if such people wished to get hold of you or express their views about what you'd written, they had to find a piece of paper and a pen with a green ink in it and an envelope and then walk all the way to the post office, etc., etc., which did tend to weed out all but the real hardcore. There was something quite impressive about them. Is there any good reason at all for newspapers and similar outlets to try and find a way to make comment sections work, or should they just drop them?
Well, I think, I mean, it's a very good question. You're absolutely right also about the green ink. These letters from Nutters were always written in green ink. And it did mean that only the real hardcore, who are deeply committed, would write the nutty letters. You would also get, of course, comment on articles, and we still do at the Times, in people writing sensible letters. And in fact, that's one of the most read bits of the paper. That's an extremely important
But this
test.
This is the letters page.
This is edited, and
the best ones are selected.
Exactly. Now, whether a newspaper should be obliged to host and put up a huge slew of ravings, usually provoked not by the article, but by the original posting, which is completely irrelevant and is going off in a different direction, I don't know. I mean, it does mean that you can simply stop reading at the end of the article, and you can read the first comment and then say, well, that's enough, which is what I do. The problem is, if you want to keep the article and you want to print it out, unfortunately, the printer will immediately print all the rest of the ravings that come beneath it.
Daniela, I wonder at what point comment sections are going to get, and I think we may be getting there, overrun by legal concerns, not so much for whether publishers should be held responsible for what's printed beneath their masthead, and I think they should be, because, Michael, am I right in saying you can't print something libelous on the letters page?
No, you can't.
You would be responsible
for
that.
Of course you would. The contents of a printed newspaper, or indeed a newspaper online, a tablet form, is entirely the newspaper's.
But, Daniela, is there not also an issue with, I guess, a duty of care that a news outlet or news organisation might have to its own actual contributors? If you ran a bar and people kept coming in insulting, haranguing and threatening the staff, you would throw those people out?
I think increasingly there are moderators for comments and commenting forums to weed out exactly the online abuse. I mean, no such thing really exists on Twitter, and I've had a few unpleasant comments and threats, shall we say, on Twitter. So I think they are keeping this. You know, this is something that online publications do. But I think it would be a bit mealy-mouthed of us to say, no, we're only going to have the comments that we like. And people have the right to talk nonsense, and they have the right to talk nonsense in a public forum. And we can't do anything about this. And people feel now when you read a piece online, you want to comment, you can comment.
But are they public forums or private spaces?
Pretty public. Pretty public, I think. Anything online is pretty public. And that's what newspapers and that's what publications want them to be, because they want them to be shared. They want this to be part of a kind of dialogue with the reader. The train has left the station. I mean, it's a two-way, if not three-way, if not four-way form of communication now. And The Guardian, for instance, have tried to co-opt this, and with having comments of the week, comments of the day, comments of the month, trying to bring some of their more thoughtful commenters into write pieces. We have to engage with it. There's no other way.
Michael, the various modifications are suggested from time to time. Some outlets turn their comment sections exclusively over to Facebook, so people therefore have to comment under their own names. As Daniela points out, you can hire moderators, but that costs money. You can spend money on software such as NRK have, but that costs money. I mean, ultimately, is it worth it? If you actually have to spend over a certain amount of time and effort to maintain a comment section, are you actually getting value for money, given that you could, not that I'm self-interested or anything, be spending this money on journalists?
Well, I think it depends who your readers are and which readers you want to attract. If I'm talking about newspapers now or publications, printed publications, if you want to attract anyone under 30 or 35, say, you need to have a comment section. If you want to annoy everyone over 50, you have a comment section. Frankly, that drives people absolutely nuts, and I never read any of them. I find they're usually ravings that I read them to make myself. Actually, that is a good argument. They make me angry, and therefore I read them saying, what is the nonsense I'm going to read now? I think Daniela's argument is by far the best one, a moderator. A moderator, it must be a pretty boring job after a while, but one person can make a big difference there, and after a bit, a moderator can change the tone, and then it becomes slightly self-regulating.
Well, on that, I think counterintuitively optimistic thought, I think they should be abolished immediately. It was so much nicer before they existed. It's at least gives, I think, journalists some idea of how professional sports people must feel having to do their job while thousands of people shout at them that they're useless. And on that humbling note, we have reached the end of today's programme. Thanks to our guests Michael Binion and Daniela Pelled. The show was produced by Ben Rylan, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Anthea Longo. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. More music next at 1900. Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck is in with The Urbanist, and there's more in the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at 1800 London time tomorrow. For now, I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.